sweets, only ripe vegetables, fresh fruit and whole wheat. I'm from the old school, my household smell like soul food, bro. Curry falafel.
What's up, beardos? Welcome to episode 71 of The Bearded Vegans. I'm Paul.
And I'm Andy.
And we are The Bearded Vegans, a podcast featuring a dissection of all things vegan.
If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find all of our previous episodes at thebeardedvegans.com, and you can always reach us by emailing thebeardedvegans@gmail.com.
In today's episode, we will talk about what we've been eating, go through the news, and then ask the question, is there a case for moral meat eating? According to the Sierra Club, the answer is yes. Stay tuned to find out more.
And before we dive into it, I just wanted to say that next episode, we will be reviewing, finally, What the Health, which is the new documentary from the Cowspiracy team. And I've already had a chance to see it, so I think it's worth talking about. But we are holding off until next week to review it because it is going to become available for the general public to stream from their website, I assume at some cost, tomorrow, if you're listening to this the day it comes out, March 16th. So if you want to be in on that discussion, I always think it's more fun to listen to those after you've seen the film. So know that you can stream the film, What the Health, at whatthehealth.com. We'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. And Paul, I think we're probably going to have to put a cap on the old health documentaries at that point, at least for a while, unless something really interesting comes along.
I think so.
I'm sure it's as uninteresting for the listeners as it is for us to watch Dr. Esselstyn and Teapot.
T. Colin.
talking about the same thing over and over again. But What the Health has some very different perspectives and really dives into some things that have not been covered in previous documentaries. So I think worth a watch.
Which B or C list celebrity will they entice into this movie? Stick around to find out.
Oh boy.
All right. So now that we got that out there, Andy, what have you been eating?
Well, Paul, I am soaking up all the delicious food out here in Los Angeles. And I'm returning to a lot of favorites, but there's this place that has been very hyped up to me. Everyone says it's amazing. You have to go. And it is a place that offers soft serve, like vegan froyo, basically. And I'm just like, how good could it really be? You know, like I like that stuff, but it's never like mind blowing.
Yeah.
And so the place has a name which really rolls off the tongue. It's called Yoga Ert.
I love it.
So it's like yoga yogurt. I don't know. It felt like they were trying to hit some kind of cool pun, and then they're just like, whatever. Let's just put a dash between the two, and we're good. So that's Yoga Ert in Glendale, California. And Paul.
Yes, Andy.
It was mind-blowingly good.
Ooh. You know, I used to work at Froyo World, and I was vegan at the time, so I could not eat the actual frozen yogurt. I could have like the sorbet stuff that they had, but I was always like, oh man, I really want frozen yogurt. When if sorbet is an option, but like ice cream or frozen yogurt is also an option, you're never going with sorbet.
Yeah, sorbet is kind of boring. Borbet, as I call it.
Ooh, yogurt.
So their base is a cashew and almond base for most of it, but they actually have probiotics in there, so it is like a yogurt.
Huh.
And they have 6 flavors every day. I tried a sample of their salted caramel flavor, and I was just like, holy crap, this is so good. So I got salted caramel with brownie chunks from Charlie's Brownies, who, nice benefit, are on the Food Empowerment Project approved chocolate list.
Very nice.
And then also, I love waffle cones, but I'm a messy eater, so I always get the cup, but I was able to get crunched up waffle cone on my froyo.
Very nice.
There's a picture of that on the Instagram over at the Bearded Vegans there. It was so good. I cannot wait to go back. Most of the toppings are fruity toppings and things of that nature. This is kind of the only chocolatey topping. They also make their own chocolate sauce as well. But Yoga-Ert, I am supremely impressed with what they did. The texture was great. The flavor was incredible. It just tasted like I was eating salted caramel, but in like frozen custard form. So
I want that so bad.
Paul.
Yes, Andy?
It's only a 6-hour plane ride away.
Only. One day.
Yes. And There's a whole lot of food going on right now. You can see pictures of all that at our Instagram. The only other one that I'm going to mention is Veggie Grill. And Veggie Grill is a place, I'm pretty sure I've talked about them before. They're not like a restaurant that I get really amped up on, partly because they're everywhere, which is exciting. But after you've been to it a bunch, it's less exciting. And also because, you know, it's a lot of like just kind of deep fried Gardein type products. So I think it's a great place to take someone who is not vegan because they can get like a fried chicken sandwich. But, you know, it loses its luster. You know, it's like when I travel, I want to go find some local vegan spot that isn't everywhere. I want to try something new. But I always end up at Veggie Grill. One, because they have an app that lets you get money off of your order, you know, like a loyalty thing going on. So that always entices me. But they have all these seasonal specials that are usually pretty cool. They had a spicy fried chicken plate with mashed potatoes and gravy and collards, and they call it corn cake. It was like a scoop of cornbread, basically. But I bring up Veggie Grill because they are now the first chain to be carrying the Beyond Burger. And it just, sometimes you just need that burger. It really hit the spot, and it just makes me very happy that Beyond Meat is like really taking steps to get their burger out there and make it as accessible as possible. So yay for Veggie Grill for helping to make that happen. And I believe I read an article not too long ago that talked about how they're going to be expanding nationwide in the coming year. So hopefully coast to coast.
East Coast.
But speaking of, and this is a little transition to the news, I guess, but speaking of chains carrying vegan burgers, it was recently announced that Bear Burger is going to be carrying the Impossible Burger.
Andy, what is Bear Burger?
I'm glad you asked. It is a chain that started in New York City, and they are now in 44 locations in 5 different countries. The closest one to you is sort of on the New York, Connecticut border, Paul, but they have a ton in New York City, all over New York City. They have them. I just looked real quickly. I didn't look at like West Coast or anything, but they had them in, you know, Philly and Baltimore and DC. So I'm glad that the Impossible Burger is starting to become a little more accessible. I have unable to find information on whether there'll be default offering a vegan bun. At Momofuku Nishi, where I tried it, you had to ask specifically for a vegan bun. It was an extra dollar, so that's not the most fun. And someone, when I posted the article on our Facebook, hey, everyone, we have a Facebook, someone commented that the location near them, the buns they have are not vegan. So that's not the best thing, but I am really happy that the Impossible Burger will be out there for more people to try.
And it's going to be at every Bear Burger.
That is, according to this article, at VegNews.com that I read, but
VegNews.com, is that an underground website for veganism?
So anyway, I don't know. It's exciting to me, Paul. I hope that it expands. I hope they expand. I want, you know, that's been my biggest problem with the Impossible Burger is how like kind of elite and inaccessible they've kept it. And at first it was like, okay. And we talked about that article a while back of, you know, the comparison between them and Beyond Burger and how they're promoting their stuff. And it's, you know, I understand what they're doing, but it's like, okay, it's been like a year where it's only been like available at these really high-end restaurants or kind of inaccessible places. So it's about time they get rolled out to a more convenient location for a lot of people.
This is a game changer.
You know, I don't use that term lightly, but yes, Paul, I believe it is a game changer.
I only use that term every other episode.
Okay. I think it's time for the news, Paul.
Let's do it.
We got a little bit of follow-up from a couple episodes ago. We talked about how the USDA removed all of its animal welfare records from its website. And this is in addition to a lot of environmental records have disappeared since Trump went in, and web pages on the White House website about you know, LGBTQ rights, and like all these, basically anything good that you could care about has been removed from the internet from the White House. But we were talking specifically about the USDA and how that was going to affect organizations like SANE, who does a lot of work with animal testing. And it turns out the USDA is now being sued because of the removal of the animal welfare record. So this is also coming from VegNews.com. just read from it briefly. Harvard Animal Law and Policy Fellow Delciana Winders, apologies for that mispronunciation, along with animal rights organizations PETA, PCRM, Beagle Freedom Project, Born Free, and MSPCA filed a lawsuit against the USDA over removal of animal welfare records from their public website earlier this month. The lawsuit alleges that the USDA violated the Freedom of Information Act, also known as FOIA, which requires federal agencies to make all records released under FOIA electronically available to the public. So I guess just want to announce that because it's a follow-up on an issue that we spent a long time talking about. I don't know if there's any opinion that we need to have on this thing other than I'm glad that these groups are holding the USDA accountable for this information because, as we mm-hmm. learned, it's very valuable for doing, you know, certain types of animal rights work, like getting under, you know, labs shut down.
Yes, I agree. I don't think I have anything to add to that.
Right on. So now you know, listeners out there. All right, so we're going to move on into something else that it's not something we would normally talk about, I don't think. But again, it's one of those things where a lot of vegans seem to have seized on this happening and used it as an opportunity to promote veganism, or at least plant-based eating. So, Paul, are you familiar with the show The Biggest Loser?
I am familiar with it. I have never seen it, though.
Yes. So Bob Harper, who is 51 and the host of The Biggest Loser and was a vegan and then quit veganism kind of publicly, back in, I saw articles as early as 2011, but some people are claiming 2013. Anyway, he suffered a heart attack while working out. And so there's an article I've seen a lot of vegans passing around that says, how could someone as fit as Bob Harper have a heart attack? And just reading briefly from that article, the article talks about how he's very healthy and he works out and all this stuff. And how he is claiming that it's because it's genetic, it's in his family history. His mother died of a heart attack at age 70. And so the article discusses all his possibilities and then it says, so there's a chance that Harper does have a mutation or some other heritable factor of heart disease, but it's also likely that there are environmental factors that are going on, says Kim Allen Williams, the chief of the cardiology division at the Rush University School of Medicine and the former president of the American College of Cardiology. Quote, you can't exercise your way out of the standard American diet, Williams says. American diets tend to be high in animal proteins, things like eggs, meat, and fish. And while that can help the younger athletes beef up more quickly, there's reason to believe that diets that are too high in protein lead to the formation of arterial plaque, which can put them at a much higher risk from heart disease as they get older. It's possible Harper fell victim to this. In 2015, he told Rachel Ray he eats 2 or 3 eggs for breakfast each morning because he wants the protein. So a lot of vegans have been posting this around as kind of a, hey, everyone, it doesn't matter how healthy you are. You have to go vegan or you're going to get a heart attack. I found a video that said Harper quits vegan, suffers heart attack. So like very directly making that link. So
yikes.
Yeah. My question for you, Paul, is this a moment vegans should be seizing upon to promote the vegan agenda?
Oh, I was about to, I have something to say. I was about to dance around your question, but I guess I'll answer your question first. I think it's kind of like a, you know, this is like an actual human that just had something like very bad happen. And I feel like it's kind of, what's the word I'm looking for?
In poor taste.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. That's exactly what I was looking for. It's in poor taste, I think, especially when, when there's articles like Harper quits vegan, suffers heart attack, it's like, whoop, you should have stayed vegan or else you'd like this wouldn't have happened to you. It's like, that's not going to, you know, that kind of attitude isn't going to win people over, I don't think. I guess it could scare people into being vegan, but I don't think that's necessarily the most efficient way to go about it. So I think, I don't know. I guess it's hard to tell. It's hard to tell if it could open up other people's eyes, like I said, and like basically scare them into being vegan. But I don't know. Why? What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think it seems kind of in poor taste, and it feels like this is a trend that we see whenever a high-profile celebrity has something like this happen to them, the vegan community, or a certain sect of the vegan community. A lot of, you know, sort of plant-based health bloggers and whatnot really jump on top of it to promote veganism that way. And it always just, I can never quite put my finger on it, but it always seems just a little off-putting, a little gross, a little too opportunistic, and a little too capitalizing on human suffering.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that I was going to say was, I'm interested because a lot of, I should say, I've seen many articles that say things very close to it, like almost exactly what this article says when it says, there's a reason to believe that diets that are too high in protein lead to the formation of arterial plaque, blah, 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 which can put you at a risk of heart disease. But I've seen a lot of articles that say this, and these articles are typically following a sentence as this one is, that say like animal, like consuming animals is typically, or consuming a diet that has a lot of animal products in it is normally higher in protein than you need. And then it will say, and a diet that's too high in protein could be bad for you, blah, 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 blah. But they never say, or sorry, they usually don't say, there's reason to believe that diets that are too high in animal protein can lead to the formation, which makes me question, like, well, I eat a lot of protein. Like, am I at a higher risk of heart disease? Because that's what this, like, if I took this sentence out of context and just read diets that are high in protein can lead to this bad stuff, then yes, I eat a diet that is very high in protein. Do you know what I mean? Like, it seems like it's not necessarily saying that, it's not condemning the fact that they're eating meat. It's condemning the fact that they're eating a specific diet that's too high in protein. And that maybe if he ate a diet that was less high in protein, he could still eat the animal stuff and it would be okay. Do you get that impression?
That did not come to mind, but I get what you're saying. I think that a lot of people perhaps, you know, unless the article really explicitly spells out the type of protein that you get from animal products is the problem. It's not protein in general.
Yeah, because I think it always comes to my mind whenever I read this, because I'm like, oh, shoot, I'm done for.
Yeah, I think you're good, Paul.
Well, this guy probably thought he was good, too.
He did. So, yeah, so I guess the sort of the moral of this whole thing for me is, you know, there might be room for it to be an educational situation, but how you do it, if you sort of do it with this smug sense of glee at like, haha, this guy was, you know, he stopped being vegan and now he has a heart attack. And it's not, in my experience, it's not necessarily going to be the thing that really kind of wins people over. And it's not the compassionate nature that I think that we should be projecting.
Yeah.
All right, time to move on.
Time to move on.
All right, Paul, sometimes you just receive a gift. And I feel like this article we are about to discuss is a gift. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about things that we think are not necessarily the best in the vegan community and things that we can do better. And today is a day where we just get to kind of pick apart someone that's telling us that we should not be vegan. And I sent you this and I was like, Paul, I'm just jumping up and down my chair and I'm like yelling at my screen reading this. And then you told me you had the same reaction.
Yes. Yes.
So this article comes to us from the Sierra Club of all places. It is titled, Is There a Moral Case for Eating Meat? And I'll say this is a very, very, very long article. And to really get at the nuances of everything, we are going to have to read a bunch from it. But what we are reading is a minuscule amount of the actual article. I so wish that we could recruit like Morgan Freeman to read this article so we could just like cut to clips of his voice. But we can't. So you got to deal with us reading stuff. So the headline is Toward a Moral Case for Eating Meat. And the subheadline is By Consuming Other Animals, We Can Affirm Our Animal Nature, Drawing Ourselves Closer to the Earth. So already you can kind of see where it's going. This whole thing kind of comes across as like some like philosophy 101, you know, freshman year paper type thing. But we're going to talk about it because it's from the freaking Sierra Club. And the Sierra Club is, according to their website, the nation's largest and most influential grassroots environmental organization. They have 2.4 million members. They were founded over 100 years ago. They're a very important organization for this country. They hold a ton of sway over how people think about how people view environmental issues. And also interesting because in Cowspiracy, he is, I believe he is the opening shot of the film, but Bruce Hamilton, who's the deputy executive director, you know, he has that moment when he's asked, like, well, what about animal agriculture? This is after he has said, you know, oh, oil shales and fracking and all these things are the number one contributor to global warming and greenhouse gases. And he's asked, what about animal agriculture? And he goes, well, what about it? And it's just this super awkward moment. Later on, they show like the extended clip of that, and he is just fumbling over his words. He has this kind of, for lack of a more vegan phrase, deer in the headlights kind of look. And I can only imagine that that was not a shining moment for the Sierra Club in general. And I tried to do some research to see if the Sierra Club has really changed their tune on this whole subject. And from searching on their website, you know, I found some articles that were promoting vegan eating in forms of like, these are, you know, recipes, but I didn't find anything in any of like the listing of programs that they have that explicitly use any language about meat eating or animal agriculture. None of that came up in the searches. According to the article we're about to discuss, the new cover story for the Sierra Magazine is about the link between cattle farming and greenhouse gases. And the article also mentions in a previous issue of the magazine, they talked about hog farmers and hard farms in general and how those are bad for the environment. So they've made some steps, but I think all eyes are still kind of on them to be like, how are you really going to respond to this? Like, you really got called out in Cowspiracy. What is your response going to be? And then this just drops in our lap.
I mean, is this like an opinion article by, I mean, that's the kind of feel that I got, that it was just kind of like an opinion article. It wasn't necessarily like, this is the Sierra Club's message from now on.
Yeah, it's not a part of their official platform or anything, but it is something that they deemed worthy of promoting.
True.
Via their website and magazine to, I assume, their 2.4 million members.
Yeah, this is true.
The article begins, I once experimented with vegetarianism for a couple years. When people asked my reason for forgoing meat, I told them that while I had no problem with killing animals, I didn't want to have to feed them. The line was too glib by half. I was a typically callow 20-something dude, but it got straight to one of my main concerns motivating vegetarians, animal agriculture, or so to emphasize, industrialized animal agriculture. So then he goes on to talk about the environmental impact of animal agriculture a little bit, and then says, but the first part of my quip, I have no problem with killing animals, revealed an ugly ambivalence, if not apathy, about the morality of destroying another being to feed myself. It was, frankly, a lame dodge to a question that any meat eater should, at some point, ask herself. What, if anything, can justify taking another animal's life? And then goes on to, in more detail, talk about how horrible industrial agriculture is for the planet and how it makes a lot of sense for people to, at the very least, start to cut down on the meat that they consume. An article goes on to say, there's no shortage of thoughtful prescriptions for how to do so. Meatless Mondays, the Reducetarian Solution, Vegan Before Six. These ideas, among many others, are strategies for harm reduction. They presume that meat is an evil, if a necessary evil. They offer little or no justification for continuing to eat meat, just prescriptions for eating less meat. The meat reduction pledges seem to be saying all bad things in moderation, including moderation, which has me wondering anew, can meat actually be a good thing? Is there any way to make a moral case for eating animals?
The answer is no, and the article ends there. The end of the show.
So, you know, it's funny, Paul, because something that's kind of this theme throughout the whole article is essentially acknowledging that there's no one out there on sort of this grand philosophy scale that's really like making a moral case for eating animals. I suppose there's people that might make some environmental cases in terms of like biodiversity or whatever it might be, but that this, the author of this article is like really searching for someone to not just say meat's bad, you should eat less of it. Like the argument that's like, it's okay to have a little bit, but like this author is looking for an argument to say that little bit that you eat is a good thing.
Yeah.
Like that you're getting a pass for that.
Yeah, and I feel like you said, they stated like no one out there has ever been able to make a case for why eating meat's a good thing. But then Jason Mark comes along, the lone hero of making a case for eating meat. This person was just like, I've been the chosen one to tackle this endeavor.
Yes, finally, thank you, someone to defend the already well defended by 97% of the population. So the author goes on to talk about looking for people that have found this argument for moral meat eating. So he talks about coming across this article by Nathaniel Johnson, who is a food and agriculture at Grist, who asked, where are the philosophers arguing that eating meat is moral? And he kind of comes up empty-handed and says, if we acknowledge that eating animals will cause them some measure of pain, then it's impossible to defend on a strictly ethical basis. And so then at the end of the piece, Johnson concludes that conscientious carnivores should support farms that prioritize animal welfare, saying, let's focus on giving farm animals a life worth living. And then, as I'll detail below, I wholeheartedly agree, but the conclusion still felt unsatisfactory. I was left wanting to hear an argument for meat eating as an ethical good. As Johnson noted, while it's almost impossible to find a moral argument in favor of killing animals, it's not at all hard to find compelling claims on the other side of the question. And so he keeps saying this, like, he's like, there must be a thing that makes it me feel good about eating animals.
Yeah. I found so much evidence against it, and I can't find anything for it. I guess what? I'll be the one to come up with that.
Yeah. So, okay. So then he talks about Peter Singer's Animal Liberation as being a very formative text in terms of really kind of informing the current day vegan ethic. I know many people have problems with him, but, you know, it's still obviously a formative piece for a lot of people. Talks about Jonathan Safran Foer's Eating Animals, which I have not read, but I know a lot of people that was the thing that made them vegan. Mm-hmm. And then he comes to the conclusion, in a nutshell, animals feel pain. And he's summarizing the philosophies of Peter Singer and Jonathan Safran Foer. Animals feel pain. They suffer in ways similar to humans, and we as humans, as moral animals, cannot in good conscience contribute to such pain. And then, again, he's just saying, he acknowledges there's no sensible reason to argue against the fact that animals suffer. Like going about this, trying to find this moral reason to eat meat doesn't make sense if you're just trying to say, well, animals don't feel pain. And then says, any moral defense of meat eating then must confront and accept some level of animal suffering. The question becomes, might the suffering that animals experience in the course of being sacrificed for human food contribute to some other social good? I think the answer is a conditional yes. So he keeps thinking there must be some way and never leads on until this point in the article in which he asks how.
This is like pretty deep in the article. And at this point, I was like, yeah, I think I agree with everything that he says, because all he's doing is giving arguments for why it's bad. And all he's doing is saying, yeah, there's no arguments for why it's good. And I'm like, okay, I can agree with this. And at this point, I was still kind of like, why did Andy send me this article? But then I found out why Andy sent me this article.
Yeah, it's so Paul.
Yes, Andy.
He does some real extraordinary backflips to reach a conclusion for moral meat eating. You want to let us into that insight?
So he continues. By eating animals, we can remind ourselves of our animal natures. That recognition of our corporal reality, the fact that we are flesh and blood and bones and skin, each of us ever on the way to very likely an unpleasant end, can, like few other things, keep us connected to the living earth. Surely such a connection is vital in an age of increasing dislocation between human civilization and non-human nature. When we kill other animals for our sustenance, as long as we do so with careful moral consideration, it can reinforce our interdependence with other species, linking humans to the rest of nature, and that linkage is a social as well as trans-species good. By taking another animal's life, we can attune ourselves to the laws of ecology and the laws of the animal world in which we as animals are a part of. Those laws state that everything is connected and that there can be a harmonious balance in the natural food chain. Mindful meat eating plugs us into that chain and connects us to the fates of other living beings. Paradoxical as it might sound, the conscientious carnivore can reestablish our moral obligations to the other species with whom we share this planet. Meat eating can be an ecological good insofar as the act reaffirms an environmental ethics that places other species' interests alongside human interests.
What?
This is like, it's like gobbledygook. It's like nonsense. This doesn't make any sense at all.
And it's being put out by the Sierra Club. Let me, again, 2.4 million members. The most influential environmental, grassroots environmental organization by their own accord. So that's why we're talking about this. This is being put out by this huge organization that has a lot of sway. So Paul, let's break it down. Is this just a big fancy way of saying, well, lions eat animals, so I should eat animals?
I think this author is trying to go beyond that and somehow saying that, and this is not the only time that this comes up in these two paragraphs, the author is trying to make a case that us eating animals is good for the animal that we're eating, basically. Like, it's like what he uses. So, and that linkage is a social as well as a trans species good. Like, he tries to make the argument that it's also good for the animals that we're eating them, but doesn't really give much. I mean, we're going to go more into the article, but doesn't really, spoiler alert, give any concrete backing for that. I didn't feel like, it's just kind of like, oh, don't worry. Like, the animals want this too, so it's all good.
It reminds me of, like, a chart that says, like, step one, eat animals. Step two, question mark. Step three, things are good for the world.
Like, yeah. It's
kind of this weird, like, mystery box. One thing goes in, another thing comes out. We don't know exactly how it happened. It's I guess it's saying that, you know, if we don't eat animals, we're so disconnected from them that we won't care about them. So in order for us to care about them and, like, reconnect with our primal nature, and then I guess, you know, have better farming conditions because we now care about them because we're eating them, it seems like that is kind of the case. And I guess I've seen this before when I've been doing outreach where someone's like, well, going vegan is just like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Like, if you don't eat animals, then you have no say in how they're treated. You're just leaving it to people that don't care about how they're treated. So you have to eat them because then your dollars are voting for better treatment of animals if you purchase meat in the, you know, the ethical way that is later detailed, quote unquote ethical way that's later detailed in this article, which is, of course, of no surprise, like, oh, eat locally, find local farms that you can visit. That is sort of the solution for ways to ethically eat meat.
But, like, when you say things like, by taking another animal's life, we can attune ourselves to the laws of ecology. Andy, what does that mean? What does that mean?
I don't know, Paul.
Like, that it means nothing. That it's nonsense. But then beyond that, it's like we've been saying, this is being put on a medium of people who are putting forth ideas of how to, like, save the environment. But then when you say things like, hey, by eating animals, we are attuning ourselves to the laws of ecology. And so I'm assuming, like, we are going to care more about the environment, but but we're doing the thing that we've also been saying is really bad for the environment.
And the article does go on to, in the tradition of the article of shooting down its own arguments, it goes on to talk about how this way of eating is not sustainable for a whole planet. We'll talk about that more later. So the laws of ecology, for anyone that is curious and unfamiliar, like I was before reading this article, is something that there are four laws of ecology. The laws of ecology are: one, everything is connected to everything else; two, everything must go somewhere; three, nature knows best; and four, There's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, so essentially it's just sort of a we are all one type philosophy from my understanding of it.
But like, what does that actually help? Like, what does that mean? Like, what is it? It's like if we're going to use that as the argument to do something bad, then if we're going to use that as the argument to do something that in the most of this article, the author has been saying like, yeah, this is a terrible thing that we're doing. Like up until then, he's only built this up as something bad. If that's the reason why we can do this, it better mean something very, very good, but really it just means nothing. It just means like, yeah, we're going to treat each other better. We're going to treat each other better if we do this. If we're going to do this thing that literally means we have to treat each other worse.
Yeah, there's never any explanation as to what actual real life changes that makes. I mean, off the top of my head, I could come up with things that's like, oh, you know, things I've already said, like that means we'll be spending our money in places where we think animals are treated better, and that, you know, because we're connected, so we care about the animal because we're eating them. But like, it's all just so super vague. And then also, it's like, is the only way to feel connected to the we are one kind of philosophy to kill an animal? I feel like there's a lot of like hippy dippy vegan bullshit out there about how like we're all connected and that's why we shouldn't kill. Like you could use the exact same argument for why you should go vegan, I think.
It's funny you say that, Andy, because reading this whole thing, I was like, did someone from Unity like break off of veganism and then write this article? Because that is exactly what it sounded like to me.
Yeah, and then the article admits that our in the words of the article, less lethal ways of connecting to nature. Like, yeah, no shit. Like, go for a walk in the woods. Like, I don't know, hang out with your dog. The article talks about like, you know, well, the connection and the symbiosis of, you know, a shepherd and his flock and how it's sort of this, you know, this trade off and you get safety, but I get to kill you eventually. And then it's like, and it says something about, you know, I imagine that's like a more meaningful exchange than eating a stalk of broccoli. But the article says like, it might just be my confirmation bias speaking. And I'm like, yes, it is definitely your confirmation bias speaking right there. Like, would you not feel connected to the we are one, everything is connected aspect of this laws of ecology, if you spent time in the soil growing vegetables and you learned how the soil got fertilized and how the sun supplies the photosynthesis. And, you know, like there's so many things that I think you could appreciate about nature and how we all can kind of work together in this one thing that I don't feel like killing an animal, you like, will all of a sudden give you more appreciation of it. It's like, in order for me to appreciate you, Paul, I have to kill you. Like, what is that?
And again, I'll say this again, because I do not get this. What's the point of appreciating nature unless that means you are going to try and do better for it? But it's like, if the thing you are doing is inherently bad for it, then it's like, then why are you doing that in the first place? It's like, I'm doing this thing that's bad for nature to feel like I should do good things about nature.
Yeah.
It's nonsense.
It's just, it's all very frustrating. The article further justifies it with this kind of just babble, but it says, to eat meat is to consume the body of the world. It offers us a chance to remember that the animal kingdom runs on blood, the mountain lion preying on the deer, the coyote going after a hare, the bobcat pouncing on a field mouse, and that we are, too, a part of that kingdom. What if we were to accept that pain is an inescapable part of being an animal? What if we were to fearlessly acknowledge our own mortality and in doing so recognize that we share something essential with animals, death itself? Like, how proud do you think the author felt when they wrote that? They're just like, oh, this is so fucking good. They're going to chisel this shit on my tombstone.
I don't like using that word, but I really hate this argument that it's like, oh, like we are animals. Like we are connecting with our animal self. It's like in no other way is this person living their day-to-day life and being like, I am an animal, and then sits down, puts their glasses on, and types out this 10,000 word essay. It's like, ooh, I'm being such an animal right now, writing on my MacBook. And yeah, and then they just, like, you know, like, they get up, they drive in their car, they go to, like, their desk job all day, they come home, open up their refrigerator, like, heat up fucking Lunchables pepperoni pizza or something like that, and then eats that pepperoni, is like, animal, I am the animal kingdom. And it's just like, this is ridiculous.
I'm consuming the body of the world right now. Yeah, it's so silly. And the whole, like, well, life is pain argument, like, yes, life is pain. Nature is red of tooth and claw. But when people are like, death is just a part of life, it's like, yes, but you would never accept, if someone just came up and, like, murdered me on the street, it wouldn't be like, ah, death's a part of life. It'd be like, that sucks. That sucks that someone killed you just now, because you didn't need to die and you probably had another 50 whatever years on you. So it's just such a ridiculous, flimsy excuse of an argument.
Yeah.
And he calls it, he tries to really kind of inflate the ego of this whole thing by calling it, you could call it ecological stoicism or maybe ecological egalitarianism. Like, ugh, give me a break.
Wait, I this was from the end of the article. I don't think you were going to say this quote, but about the death thing. This is like the last, second to last paragraph. He says, as for animal rights versus animal welfare, I would argue that while every creature deserves the respect of a humane death, no animal has the right to live forever, humans included. We too will end up as worm food, the cycle of life and death turning once more. And it's like, yeah, but does that mean that we get to decide when? Like, he's trying to say, like, oh, everyone's going to die, so that means we get to decide just when certain things get to die. Not, like, not us, obviously not humans, because, you know, if we killed another human, that would be terrible. So it's like, like, he's saying, like, yeah, humans are included in this cycle of life and death, but it's like, we can't just go around killing other humans, just like we shouldn't just go around killing other animals. That's nonsense. I hate
that. Yeah, it just, that line, no animal has the right to live forever, it's like, that's not up for debate. No one ever said that was the case. No animal has the ability to live forever. So, like, why are you bringing rights into this?
There's a part in the article where the author talks about going to this this farm that's, like, it seems like it's, like, a very, you know, like, a free-range farm. All the animals are just kind of, like, chilling out on a lot of stuff. The author says that the animals are very, very happy many, many times. But then the owner of the farm says something that I thought was interesting. The owner, whose name is unfortunately also Paul, says, like, oh, because this is talking about, like, the mutual respect between farmer and pig. He's just talking about the pigs and how, like, how much the farmers, like, how well they treated their pigs and why they felt they needed to treat their pigs well. And this is what it says. It says, Paul says, we feel a lot of responsibility to them because they chose to live with us. And I was like, what does that mean? And then the next paragraph says, there are about 45,000 species of birds, fish, and mammals on Earth. We have domesticated some 45 of them. They chose us as much as we chose them, Paul argues, striking a grand bargain in which we provide to them food and safety, and they in turn eventually become our food. And I was like, chose is an interesting word to use. It's like, yes, I bought these pigs, and now they live on my farm. These pigs chose to live here. I was like, I don't think this person knows what chose means.
Yeah. I'm sorry that you share a name, Paul.
It's okay.
He's besmirching the good name of Paul.
But yeah, that I thought that was such, like, a strange way to justify, like, oh yes, I'm able to kill pigs because these pigs are choosing this life and they're choosing to want to be killed for me to eat. It's like, ugh. It, like, it really makes it, that little quote that I read really makes it seem like this author truly believes that the animals had some say in how we are treating them, you know?
to me, it feels like when people say, well, animals sacrifice their life to us. They give their life to us. It's like, no, you take their life from them. They don't give their life willingly to us. So then the article at one point talks about this idea of extending the basic principle of equality. So the article says, a curious thing about some of the animal rights philosophy is that at times it seems to make equality into a one-way street, and then goes on to discuss how Peter Singer coined this idea of extending the basic principle of equality, and says, implicit in that line is the idea that humans will raise other animals to the ethical plane we inhabit. So, you know, essentially this idea that, like, you know, each animal has needs that are not the same as the human, but, you know, humans have, you know, the ability to feel pain. Animals have the ability to feel pain. So we should consider those things equally. Obviously, an animal doesn't need the right to drive a car or get married, whatever it might be. And so the article goes on to say, implicit in that line is the idea that humans will raise other animals to the ethical plane we inhabit. Maybe we humans should stretch in the other direction and acknowledge that we are animals, too, driven in large part by instinct. Such an acknowledgement might prompt us to consider that our equality with other animals rests less on our ability to feel pain than on the common way in which we are driven by instincts.
Again, it's like, what other, like, where in this person, in this author's day-to-day life, where else is he like, oh, yeah, I really driven by instincts when I got up to sharpen my pencil at the pencil sharpener, you know, that was a bad example, but it's like, I couldn't think of anything else.
No one uses pencil sharpeners anymore, Paul.
It's like, I feel like we are a civilized people because we don't like just lower ourselves to our basic instincts. Like when someone cuts you off in the road, it's like, yeah, you might get angry at them, but you're not going to just like go and smash your car into their car. It's like, we exist like we do today because we're able to like rationally think and we are not just driven by our instincts. So you can't really make this argument that's like, yeah, look how far we've progressed by like being rational. But in this one thing, like we're allowed to be, in this one aspect of my life, I'm allowed to be an animal and resort down to my base instincts because, you know, it's the thing that I want to do. And I really, really needed an argument for doing it. And no one else had an argument for doing it.
Yeah. I mean, what this paragraph is saying to me is, why does it have to be a one-way street? Why can't it go both ways? Like, well, if they can be equal with us, doesn't that mean that if we're equal with them, we should be able to kill them? And to me, it reminds me of when people are like, women want equal rights. Well, shouldn't we be able to punch them then? And it's just like, really? Like, that's what you want out of this situation? Like, you want to be able to kill animals and like, oh, if we're going to be equal, then I should be able to kill you? Like, it just seems like such a flimsy argument. That shouldn't be the first thing that you're looking for when you're trying to like get on an equal plane with someone.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I made the mistake of like drifting a little bit too low on this webpage and getting into the comments section. And I only read like the first handful of comments and they were actually mostly like, wow, this argument is absolutely ridiculous. But one thing that kept coming or that came up a few times was like, this person could literally be making this argument for eating humans. Like, why wouldn't that just be like, why couldn't he use the same, like use this same argument? Like, oh, well, we're all just animals. And like you already said, Andy, like, well, I want to feel connected to you, so I need to kill you and eat you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I was happy to see that a lot of people were pointing out how ridiculous it was. It seems like just such flimsy argumentation. The article talks about, I already alluded to this, but the article says that, like, acknowledges that this is not a way for a global population to eat, which to me, like, really fails a test of, like, what should we be promoting if it's not, like, a global ethic that we can preach, then why even bring it up in the first place?
And we know that from Cowspiracy, too, right? That was the, yeah, I believe it was Cowspiracy that said, like, hey, this type of farming that this author is promoting is just not realistic if anyone wants to consume as much meat as we want to consume in the United States.
Yeah. the article ends with that quote that you were talking about, Paul. No animal has the right to live forever. And then he says, I can't imagine a better end than having my ashes dumped in the compost pile so that my bones might feed the soil that helps feed my family. If you find such a thought uncomfortable, then good. Mindful meat eating forces us to remember that we too, despite all of our rational powers and moral capacities, will eventually pass away. Through the commonality of death, we reaffirm our kinship with the other animals on Earth.
I think he's creating a false analogy there when he says, I can't imagine a better end than having my ashes dumped in the compost pile, blah, 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 blah. If he wanted to truly create an analogy to what he's proposing, it would be, I can't imagine a better end that really not knowing what's going on in my life, and then one day out of nowhere, someone killing me. Because like his analogy that he's trying to create is like, has nothing to do with like the fact that we are completely controlling every aspect of these animals' lives and then just choosing to kill them. And to that animal, it's going to be, they have no idea what or when is going on and why it's going on. So it's like the real analogy would be like, yeah, I've been kept in captivity all my life and then they kill me one day. But then my ashes are dumped in a compost pile and it's so great.
Yeah. And like, you know, as we know from, watching At the Fork, which was that kind of Whole Foods, I believe, produced documentary, the one that was in favor of this type of eating, you know, local. And they showed us all these very, like, the best of the best, super local, super, you know, above and beyond step five at Whole Foods type places. And we're still kind of like, this is still kind of not pleasant to watch. So on that, like, the analogy could also be like, I'd really love for my caretaker to make me believe they have my best interest in mind and then one day find out they're going to kill me and sell my flesh for profit. Like, that is what happens to those animals. That's not like some symbiotic relationship where they're like, yes, please take my body and like eat me and then become, you know, it's just like, it's so ridiculous. He's projecting things onto animals that are not there and using it as justification for eating animals.
Also, I think this is like a smaller note, but I think at one point he says like that being vegetarian is like too hard for it to be adopted worldwide. And my first thought about that was like, well, yeah, it's too hard because it's not too hard because the act of being vegan or vegetarian is too hard. It's too hard because of lack of like access to good food, to good vegetarian or vegan foods, or like food deserts and stuff like this. It's these other contributing factors. Like being vegan or being vegetarian would not be hard if these other things were taken care of that are surrounding veganism and vegetarianism, and they have to do with it, but it's not the act of being vegan or vegetarian. And he later on says towards the end, it's like, yeah, but this is, oh, like you have this quote. I'm just going to read it right now. He says, I admit that mindful meat eating is incredibly difficult in the same way that mindfulness in general is difficult. It's hard to approach any given moment with a high intention, with a high intentionality quotient. I would be lying if I were to claim that with every bite of meat, I engage a meditation on morality. So he's basically saying like, he's trying to, you know, make this strong argument. And then it's like, but it's hard sometimes, so I don't actually follow this thing, this nonsense that I've been spouting out anyways. And it's like, you live in San Francisco. It's probably not hard to be vegan or vegetarian there.
Yeah, he was like, in San Francisco, it's really easy to get this type of meat. And I was like, that is one of the most vegan-friendly places in the United States, if not the planet. At the end of the article, he talks about how it's very difficult, by his own admission, to eat the way that he's proposing. And that, you know, sometimes he will stray and sometimes he will just go to some local barbecue joint where he doesn't know, like, where the meat is coming from. And then he gets away with this because early in the article, he said, if you spent any amount of time thinking about the morality of meat eating, you might have already came to this conclusion, the conclusion that it's like bad to eat animals. But if you're like 97% of Americans, you still eat meat. Isn't this blatant hypocrisy? Not necessarily, according to ethicist Paul Thompson. Sorry, another Paul there.
No!
The author of From Field to Fork, Farm Ethics for Everyone. Moral ideals are exactly that, ideals. Something we strive for. A Christian, for example, isn't necessarily a bad Christian just because she doesn't give away all of her worldly possessions to the poor. Charity doesn't require asceticism. Asceticism? You know, so he, like, early on, he sets the tablework for the end of this article saying that, look, it's just an ideal. You don't have to be 100% perfect, so it's okay to stray from it. And I don't know, it just, it feels like, we talk about this, Paul. We talk about how, like, it's impossible to be 100% vegan, but this is just kind of something where it's, but, like, our version of not being 100% vegan is like, okay, we have to drive on roads and tires and maybe our computers have animal products in them. But this is one that's just like, eh, when, you know, whatever, if you're craving it, like, go for it. It's like a way lower bar that's being set. Did you have any other specific things you want to talk about, or can we wrap it up?
I think we can wrap it up. I've talked about this enough now.
Yeah. So overall, you know, if this was just some, like, small little article that was on some rando's blog, we might not talk about it. Every now and then we pull one of those things out just for fun. But this is something that, again, is being put out by this incredibly well-regarded organization that a lot of people take their cues from. So hopefully by listening to this, if someone does post this on your page as like a gotcha, hopefully this arms you with a couple of arguments that you can use against it. Though I'd imagine a lot of people, as they read it, they're probably laughing through it and yelling at their screens just as we were. And you know, I guess, Paul, all this is to say that, like, I think that there are probably situational circumstances in which people could argue that eating meat is ethical. We talk about that all the time. If someone doesn't have access to, you know, healthy vegan food, you know, obviously people in certain areas on the globe that don't have access, as well as, like, in our own country here, food deserts, as you already mentioned. And it, like, doesn't talk about, like, those nuances at all. Like, I you know, me personally, I don't think that eating animals is inherently unethical. But when we have alternatives, as we do in abundance for anyone, most people with access to supermarkets, you know, it's hard to see that anyone could make an argument for eating animals. And the whole article is basically saying that there is not a good argument for eating animals.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, like, basically, Paul, the whole article is just constantly bringing up way better arguments for not eating meat and then being like, but if you want to, you should, because I am now giving you this tool for why you should eat it. You can just tell people you're connecting with the animal kingdom. It's like all the bad arguments rolled into one. We're animals. We're part of the food chain. It's natural. You know, it brings up our teeth at one point. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully even people that eat meat will see through this, kind of. Like, I hope it just doesn't reinforce them. And like, maybe, like, maybe this article is just so ridiculous that people that do eat meat will read this and be like, oh, wait, wait, what am I doing with my life? This is what I am. Like, this is my thinking. This is my justification for eating meat. So maybe it will have a positive effect on veganism.
I hope so.
Like, maybe this is a PETA style thing where this person is, they're pulling like a bait and switch, and they're going to, like, they're making this real ridiculous argument, and meat eaters are going to be like, yeah, you're right. And then they're going to be like, just kidding. That was ridiculous. And you should be ashamed of yourself.
Yeah. It's like, is this an Onion article? What's going on?
Yeah. Very, very unity-ish.
Well, I think we can, yeah, seriously, we could put a cap on this discussion.
I think so.
I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun doing it, though.
This was like a much lighter episode than
little,
what we've been
little
doing.
Cathartic.
Yeah, we got the mailbag episode and then 71 into a light one.
So if you have read this article and you have an opinion on it, that is, if you like what we said, if you think we're totally wrong on this one, hit us up at thebeardedvegans@gmail.com or just go to thebeardedvegans.com. Let us know what you think about this or any other topic that you want us to be talking about. We always appreciate it. Emails are always saved for the next mailbag. So do that. Head over to the Instagram and the Facebook and all that good stuff.
So what do you, What do you got coming up, Andy?
March 26th, I'll be at the Vegan Street Fair. That's coming up in Los Angeles, California. April 1st, I'll be at Texas Veg Fest in Austin, Texas. April 8th and 9th, I'll be at the Nashville Veg Fest in Nashville, Tennessee. April 29th, I'll be at the Indie Veg Fest in Indianapolis.
The Andy Veg Fest.
April 30th, I'll be at the Michigan Veg Fest in Novi, Michigan. And there's several other events past that. You can find all the information at CompassionCo.com.
Nice.
Paul, I think, you know, we've pretty safely concluded there's not a good moral case for eating meat if you have alternatives.
Yes.
But I would argue that it is your moral imperative to say the following seven words.
We are the Bearded Vegan, signing off. Wait, Andy, did you just ask me to read the thing and then I was about to read it and then you read it? What just happened?
I thought that I was like reading an intro and like, or like prompting you to read, because I didn't want you to read something that I had like half-assed, like wrote a thing of, because like a lot of that is just me summarizing.
Yeah. I was so confused.
I don't know if you're gonna like decipher all my stuff.
No, I can.
You got it. Okay. And then at the end of the piece, Johnson concludes that conscientious carnivores should support farms that prioritize animal welfare, saying, I'm sorry, I'm still doing it.
What's happening?
I'm just going to keep going until he talks about the how.
Just keep going, Andy. Just keep going.
Oh, my God. Okay.